Penguin Audiobooks presents The Breathing Method by Stephen King. Read by Frank Muller.
1. The Club. I dressed a bit more speedily than normal on that snowy, windy, bitter night, I admit. It was December 23rd, 1977, and I suspect that there were other members of the club who did the same. Taxis are notoriously hard to come by in New York on stormy nights, so I called for a radio cab. I did this at 5:30 for an 8 o'clock pickup. My wife raised an eyebrow, but said nothing. I was under the canopy of the apartment building on East 58th Street, where Ellen and I had lived since 1946, by 7:45. And when the taxi was 5 minutes late, I found myself pacing up and down impatiently. The taxi arrived at 8:10, and I got in, too glad to be out of the wind to be as angry with the driver as he probably deserved. That wind, part of a cold front that had swept down from Canada the day before, meant business. It whistled and whined around the cab's window, occasionally drowning out the salsa on the driver's radio and rocking the big checker on its springs. Many of the stores were open, but the sidewalks were nearly bare of last-minute shoppers. Those that were abroad looked uncomfortable or actually pained. It had been flurrying on and off all day, and now the snow began again, coming first in thin membranes, then twisting into cyclone shapes ahead of us in the street. Coming home that night, I would think of the combination of snow, a taxi, and New York City with considerably greater unease. But I did not, of course, know that then. At the corner of 2nd and 40th, a large tinsel Christmas bell went floating through the intersection like his spirit. "Bad night," the cabbie said. "They'll have an extra 2 dozen in the morgue tomorrow. Wino popsicles, plus a few bag lady popsicles." "I suppose," the cabbie ruminated. "Well, good riddance," he said finally. "Less welfare, right?" "Your Christmas spirit," I said, "is stunning in its width and depth." The cabbie ruminated. "You one of those bleeding-heart liberals?" he asked finally. "I refuse to answer, on the grounds that my answer might tend to incriminate me," I said. The cabbie gave a "Why do I always get the Weisenheimers?" snort, but he shut up. He let me out at 2nd and 35th, and I walked halfway down the block to the club, bent over against the whistling wind, holding my hat on my head with one gloved hand. In almost no time at all, the life force seemed to have been driven deep into my body, a flickering blue flame about the size of the pilot light in a gas oven. At 73, a man feels the cold quicker and deeper. That man should be home, in front of a fireplace, or at least in front of an electric heater. At 73, hot blood isn't even really a memory. It's more of an academic report. The latest flurry was letting up, but snow as dry as sand still beat into my face. I was glad to see that the steps leading up to the door of 249B had been sanded. That was Stevens' work, of course. Stevens knew the base alchemy of old age well enough. Not lead into gold, but bones into glass. When I think about such things, I believe that God probably thinks a great deal like Groucho Marx. Then Stevens was there holding the door open, and a moment later I was inside. Down the mahogany-paneled hallway, through double doors standing three-quarters of the way open on the recessed tracks, into the library, come reading room, come bar. It was a dark room, in which occasional pools of light gleamed, reading lamps. A richer, more textured light glowed across the oak parquet floor, and I could hear the steady snap of birch logs in the huge fireplace. The heat radiated all the way across the room. Surely there is no welcome for a man or a woman that can equal a fire on the hearth. A paper rustled, dry, slightly impatient. That would be Johansson with his Wall Street Journal after 10 years. It was possible to recognize his presence simply by the way he read his stocks. Amusing, and in a quiet way, amazing. Stevens helped me off with my overcoat, murmuring that it was a dirty night. WCBS was now forecasting heavy snow before morning. I agreed that it was indeed a dirty night and looked back into that big high-ceilinged room again. A dirty night, a roaring fire, and a ghost story. Did I say that at 73 hot blood is a thing of the past? Perhaps so. But I felt something warm in my chest at the thought, something that hadn't been caused by the fire or Stephen's reliable, dignified welcome. I think it was because it was McCarran's turn to tell the tale. I had been coming to the brownstone, which stands at 249B East 35th Street, for 10 years, coming at intervals that were almost, but not quite, regular. In my own mind, I think of it as a gentleman's club, that amusing, pre-glorious Steinem antiquity. But even now I am not sure that's what it really is, or how it came to be in the first place. On the night Emlyn McCarran told his story, the story of the breathing method, there were perhaps 13 club members in all, although only 6 of us had come out on that howling bitter night. I can remember years when there might have been as few as 8 full-time members, and others when there were at least 20, and perhaps more. I suppose Stevens might know how it all came to be. One thing I am sure of is that Stevens has been there from the first, no matter how long that may be, and I believe Stevens to be older than he looks, much, much older. He has a faint Brooklyn accent, but in spite of that he is as brutally correct and as cuttingly punctilious as a third-generation English butler. His reserve is part of his often maddening charm, and Stevens's small smile is a locked and latched door. I have never seen any club records, if he keeps them. I have never gotten a receipt of dues. There are no dues. I have never been called by the club secretary. There is no secretary. And at 249B East 35th, there are no phones. There is no box of white marbles and black balls. And the club, if it is a club, has never had a name. I first came to the club, as I must continue to call it, as a guest of George Waterhouse. Waterhouse headed the law firm for which I had worked since 1951. My progress upward in the firm, one of New York's 3 biggest, had been steady but extremely slow. I was a slogger, a mule for work, something of a center-puncher. But I had no real flair or genius. I had seen men who had begun at the same time I had, promoted in giant steps, while I only continued to pace. And I saw it with no real surprise. Waterhouse and I had exchanged pleasantries, attended the obligatory dinner put on by the firm each October, and had little more congress until one fall in the 1960s, when he dropped by my office one day in early November. This in itself was unusual enough, and it had me thinking black thoughts, dismissal, that were counterbalanced by giddy ones, an unexpected promotion. It was a puzzling visit. Waterhouse leaned in the doorway, his Phi Beta Kappa key gleaming mellowly on his vest, and talked in amiable generalities. None of what he said seemed to have any real substance or importance. I kept expecting him to finish the pleasantries and get down to cases. Now about this case he briefed, for we've been asked to research the mayor's appointment of Salkowitz, too, but it seemed there were no cases. He glanced at his watch, said he had enjoyed our talk and that he had to be going. I was still blinking, bewildered, when he turned back and said casually, "There's a place where I go most Thursday nights, a sort of club. Old duffers mostly, but some of them are good company. They keep a really excellent cellar, if you've a palate. Every now and then someone tells a good story as well. Why not come down some night, David, as my guest?" I stammered some reply. Even now I'm not sure what it was. I was bewildered by the offer. It had a spur-of-the-moment sound, but there was nothing spur-of-the-moment about his eyes. Blue Anglo-Saxon ice under the bushy white whorls of his eyebrows, and if I don't remember exactly how I replied, it was because I felt suddenly sure that this offer, vague and puzzling as it was, had been exactly the specific I had kept expecting him to get down to. Ellen's reaction that evening was one of amused exasperation. I had been with Waterhouse, Carden, Lawton, Fraser, and Effingham for something like 15 years, and it was clear enough that I could not expect to rise much above the mid-level position I now held. It was her idea that this was the firm's cost-efficient substitute for a gold watch. "Old men telling war stories and playing poker," she said. "A night of that, and you're supposed to be happy in the reading library until they pension you off, I suppose. Oh, I put 2 becks on ice for you," and she kissed me warmly. I suppose she had seen something on my face. God knows she's good at reading me after all the years we've spent together. Nothing happened over a course of weeks. When my mind turned to Waterhouse's odd offer, certainly odd, coming from a man with whom I met less than a dozen times a year and whom I only saw socially at perhaps three parties a year, including the company party in October, I suppose that I had been mistaken about the expression in his eyes that he really had made the offer casually and had forgotten it, or regretted it. Ouch! And then he approached me one late afternoon, a man of nearly 70, who was still broad-shouldered and athletic-looking. I was shrugging on my topcoat with my briefcase between my feet. He said, "If you'd still like to have a drink at the club, why not come tonight?" "Well, I..." "Good." He slapped a slip of paper into my hand. "Here's the address." He was waiting for me at the foot of the steps that evening, and Stevens held the door for us. The wine was as excellent as Waterhouse had promised. He made no attempt whatsoever to introduce me around. I took that for snobbery, but later recanted the idea. But two or three of them introduced themselves to me. One of those who did so was Emlyn McCarran, even then in his late 60s. He held out his hand, and I clasped it briefly. His skin was dry, leathery, tough, almost turtle-like. He asked me if I played bridge. I said I did not. "God-damned good thing," he said. "That god-damned game has done more in this century to kill intelligent after-dinner conversation than anything else I can think of." And with that pronouncement he walked away into the murk of the library, where shelves of books went up apparently to infinity. I looked around for Waterhouse, but he had disappeared. Feeling a little uncomfortable and a lot out of place, I wandered over to the fireplace. It was, as I believe I have already mentioned, a huge thing. It seemed particularly huge in New York, where apartment dwellers such as myself have trouble imagining such a benevolence big enough to do anything more than popcorn or toast bread. The fireplace at 249B East 35th was big enough to broil an ox whole. There was no mantel. Instead, a brawny stone arch curved over it. This arch was broken in the center by a keystone which jutted out slightly. It was just on the level of my eyes, and although the light was dim, I could read the legend engraved on that stone with no trouble. "It is the tale, not he who tells it." "Here you go, David," Waterhouse said from my elbow, and I jumped. He hadn't deserted me after all, and only trudged off into some uncharted locale to bring back drinks. "Scotch and soda's yours, isn't it?" "Yes, thank you, Mr. Waterhouse." "George," he said. "Here it's just George." "George, then," I said, although it seemed slightly mad to be using his first name. "What is all of..." "Cheers," he said. We drank. Stevens tends the bar. He makes fine drinks. He likes to say it's a small but vital skill. The scotch took the edge off my feelings of disorientation and awkwardness. The edge, but the feelings themselves remained. I had spent nearly half an hour gazing into my closet and wondering what to wear. I had finally settled on dark brown slacks and a rough tweed jacket that almost matched them, hoping I would not be wandering into a group of men either turned out in tuxedos or wearing blue jeans and L.L. Bean's lumberjack shirts. It seemed that I hadn't gone too far wrong on the matter of dress, anyway. A new place and a new situation make one crucially aware of every social act, no matter how small, and at that moment, drink in hand and the obligatory small toast made, I wanted very much to be sure that I hadn't overlooked any of the amenities. "Is there a guest book I ought to sign?" I asked. "Something like that?" He looked mildly surprised. "Oh, we don't have anything like that," he said. "At least, I don't think we do." He glanced around the dim, quiet room. Johansson rattled his Wall Street Journal. I saw Stevens pass in a doorway at the far end of the room, ghostly in his white mess jacket. George put his drink on an end table and tossed a fresh log onto the fire. Sparks corkscrewed up the black throat of the chimney. "What does that mean?" I asked, pointing to the inscription on the keystone. "Any idea?" Waterhouse read it carefully, as if for the first time. "It is the tale, not he who tells it." "I suppose I have an idea," he said. "You may, too, if you should come back." "Yes, I should say you may have an idea or two in time. Enjoy yourself, David." He walked away. And although it may seem odd having been left to sink or swim in such an unfamiliar situation, I did enjoy myself. For one thing, I have always loved books, and there was a trove of interesting ones to examine here. I walked slowly along the shelves, examining the spines as best I could in the faint light, pulling one out now and then, and pausing once to look out a narrow window at the Second Avenue intersection up the street. I stood there and watched through the frost-rimed glass as the traffic light at the intersection cycled from red to green to amber and back to red again, and quite suddenly I felt the queerest and yet very welcome sense of peace come to me. It did not flood in. Instead, it seemed almost to steal in. Oh, yes, I can hear you saying, that makes great sense. Watching a stop-and-go light gives everyone a sense of peace. All right, it made no sense, I grant you that, but the feeling was there just the same. It made me think for the first time in years of the winter nights in the Wisconsin farmhouse where I grew up, lying in bed in a drafty upstairs room and marking the contrast between the whistle of the January wind outside, drifting snow as dry as sand along miles of snow fence, and the warmth my body created under the two quilts. There were some law books, but they were pretty damn strange. 20 cases of dismemberment and their outcomes under British law is one title I remember. Pet Cases was another. I opened that one, and sure enough, it was a scholarly legal tome dealing with the law's treatment, American law this time, of cases which bore in some important respect upon pets. Everything from house cats that had inherited great sums of money to an ocelot that had broken its chain and seriously injured a postman. There was a set of Dickens, a set of Defoe, a nearly endless set of Trollope. And there was also a set of novels, 11 of them, by a man named Edward Gray Seville. They were bound in handsome green leather, and the name of the firm gold-stamped on the spine was Stedham and Son. I had never heard of Seville or of his publishers. The copyright date of the first Seville, These Were Our Brothers, was 1911. The date of the last, The Breakers, was 1935. Two shelves down from the set of Seville novels was a large folio volume which contained careful step-by-step plans for erector set enthusiasts. Next to it was another folio volume which featured famous scenes from famous movies. Each of these pictures filled one whole page, and opposite each, filling the facing pages, were free verse poems, either about the scenes with which they were paired or inspired by them. Not a very remarkable concept, but the poets who were represented were remarkable. Robert Frost, Marianne Moore, William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens, Louis Zukofsky, and Erica Jong, just to mention a few. Halfway through the book, I found a poem by Algernon Williams set next to that famous photograph of Marilyn Monroe standing on the subway grating and trying to hold her skirt down. The poem was titled The Toll, and it began, "The shape of the skirt is, we would say, the shape of a bell. The legs are the clapper." And some such more. Not a terrible poem, but certainly not Williams's best or anywhere near the top drawer. I felt I could hold such an opinion because I had read a good deal of Algernon Williams over the years. I could not, however, recall this poem about Marilyn Monroe, which it is. The poem announces it, even when divorced from the picture. At the end, Williams writes, "My legs clap my name, Marilyn Marbell." I have looked for it since then and haven't been able to find it, which means nothing, of course. Poems are not like novels or legal opinions. They are more like blown leaves, and any omnibus volume entitled The Complete So-and-So must certainly be a lie. Poems have a way of getting lost under sofas. It is one of their charms and one of the reasons they endure. But at some point, Stevens came by with a second scotch. By then I had settled into a chair of my own with a volume of Ezra Pound. It was as fine as the first. As I sipped it, I saw two of those present, George Gregson and Harry Stein. Harry was 6 years dead on the night Evelyn McCarran told us the story of the breathing method. Leave the room by a peculiar door that could not have been more than 42 inches high. It was an Alice down the rabbit hole door, if there ever was one. They left it open, and shortly after their odd exit from the library, I heard the muted click of billiard balls. Stevens passed by and asked if I would like another scotch. I declined with real regret. He nodded, "Very good, sir." His face never changed, and yet I had an obscure feeling that I had somehow pleased him. Laughter startled me from my book some time later. Someone had thrown a packet of chemical powder into the fire and turned the flames momentarily party-colored. I thought of my boyhood again, but not in any wistful, sloppily romantic, nostalgic way. I feel a great need to emphasize that, God knows why. I thought of times when I had done just such a thing as a kid, but the memory was a strong one, pleasant, untinged with regret. I saw that most of the others had drawn chairs up around the hearth in a semicircle. Stevens had produced a heaping, smoking platter of marvelous hot sausages. Harry Stein returned through the down-the-rabbit-hole door, introducing himself hurriedly but pleasantly to me. Gregson remained in the billiard room, practicing shots by the sound. After a moment's hesitation, I joined the others. A story was told, not a pleasant one. It was Norman Stett who told it, and while it is not my purpose to recount it here, perhaps you'll understand what I mean about its quality if I tell you that it was about a man who drowned in a telephone booth. When Stett, who is also dead now, finished, someone said, "You should have saved it for Christmas, Norman." There was laughter, which I, of course, did not understand, at least not then. Waterhouse himself spoke up then. And such a Waterhouse I never would have dreamed of in 1,000 years of dreaming. A graduate of Yale, Phi Beta Kappa, silver-haired, three-piece-suited, head of a law firm so large it was more enterprise than company, this Waterhouse told a story that had to do with a teacher who had gotten stuck in a privy. The privy stood behind the one-room schoolhouse in which she had taught, and the day she got her caboose jammed into one of the privy's two holes also happened to be the day the privy was scheduled to be taken away as Anniston County's contribution to the Life as It Was in New England exhibition being held at the Prudential Center in Boston. The teacher hadn't made a sound during all the time it took to load the privy onto the back of a flatbed truck and to spike it down. She was struck dumb with embarrassment and horror, Waterhouse said. And when the privy door blew off into the passing lane on Route 128 in Somerville during rush hour... But draw a curtain over that, and over any other stories which might have followed it. They are not my stories tonight. At some point, Stevens produced a bottle of brandy that was more than just good. It was damn near exquisite. It was passed around, and Johansson raised a toast. The toast, one might almost say. The tale, not he who tells it. We drank to that. Not long after, men began slipping away. It wasn't late, not yet midnight anyway, but I've noticed that when your 50s give way to your 60s, late begins coming earlier and earlier. I saw Waterhouse slipping his arms into the overcoat Stevens was holding open for him, and decided that must be my cue. I thought it strange that Waterhouse would slip away without so much as a word to me, which certainly seemed to be what he was doing. If I had come back from shelving the pound book 40 seconds later, he would have been gone, but no stranger than most of the other things that had gone on that evening. I stepped out just behind him, and Waterhouse glanced around as if surprised to see me, and almost as if he had been startled out of a light doze. "Share a taxi?" he asked, as though we had just met by chance on this deserted, windy street. "Thank you," I said. I meant thanks for a great deal more than his offer to share a cab, and I believe that was unmistakable in my tone, but he nodded as if that were all I had meant. A taxi with its for-hire light lit was cruising slowly down the street. Fellows like George Waterhouse seemed to luck onto cabs even on those miserably cold or snowy New York nights when you would swear there isn't a cab to be had on the entire island of Manhattan. And he flagged it. Inside, safely warm, the taxi meter charting our journey in measured clicks, I told him how much I had enjoyed his story. I couldn't remember laughing so hard or so spontaneously since I was 18, I told him, which was not flattery, but only the simple truth. Oh, how kind of you to say. His voice was chillingly polite. I subsided, feeling a dull flush on my cheeks. One does not always need to hear a slam to know that the door has been closed. When the taxi drew up to the curb in front of my building, I thanked him again, and this time he showed a trifle more warmth. "It was good of you to come on such short notice," he said. "Come again if you like. Don't wait for an invitation. We don't stand much on ceremony at 249B. Thursdays are best for stories, but the club is there every night." Am I then to assume membership? The question was on my lips. I meant to ask it. It seemed necessary to ask it. I was only mulling it over, listening to it in my head, in my tiresome lawyer's way, to hear if I'd got the phrasing right. Perhaps that was a little too blunt when Waterhouse told the cabbie to drive on. The next moment the taxi was rolling on toward Park. I stood there on the sidewalk for a moment, the hem of my topcoat whipping around my shins, thinking, he knew I was going to ask that question. He knew it, and he purposely had the driver go on before I could. Then I told myself that was utterly absurd, paranoid even, and it was. But it was also true. I could scoff all I liked. None of the scoffing changed that essential certainty. I walked slowly to the door of my building and went inside. Ellen was 60% asleep when I sat down on the bed to take off my shoes. She rolled over and made a fuzzy, interrogative sound deep in her throat. I told her to go back to sleep. She made the muzzy sound again. This time it approximated English. How was it? For a moment I hesitated, my shirt half unbuttoned, and I thought with one moment's utter clarity, if I tell her, I will never see the other side of that door again. It was all right, I said. Old men telling war stories. I told you so. But it wasn't bad. I might go back again. It might do me some good with the firm. The firm. She mocked lightly. What an old buzzard you are, my love. Met him, passed him, would be more accurate. He nodded my way and went on without speaking, as he had done for years. My stomach muscles ached all day long. That was the only thing that completely convinced me the evening had been real. 3 weeks passed. 4, 5... No second invitation came from Waterhouse. Somehow I just hadn't been right, hadn't fit, or so I told myself. It was a depressing, disappointing thought. I supposed it would begin to fade and lose its sting, as all disappointments eventually do, but I thought of that evening at the oddest moments, the isolated pools of library lamplight so still and tranquil and somehow civilized. Waterhouse's absurd and hilarious tale of the schoolteacher stuck in the privy, the rich smell of leather in the narrow stacks. Most of all, I thought of standing by that narrow window and watching the frost crystals change from green to amber to red. I thought of that sense of peace I had felt. During that same 5-week period, I went to the library and checked out 4 volumes of Algernon Williams' poetry. I had 3 others myself and had already always write. Don't wait for an invitation. Anyway, that's how it happened that, on December 10th of that year, I found myself putting on my rough tweed coat and dark brown pants again and looking for my darkish red tie. I was rather more aware of my heartbeat than usual that night, I remember. George Waterhouse finally broke down and asked you back, Ellen asked, back into the sty with the rest of the male chauvinist oinkers. That's right, I said, thinking it must be the first time in at least 12 years that I had told her a lie. And then I remembered that after the first meeting I had answered her question about what it had been like with a lie. Old men telling war stories, I had said. Well, maybe there really will be a promotion in it, she said, though, without much hope. To her credit, she said it without much bitterness, either. Stranger things have happened, I said, and kissed her goodbye. Oink, oink, she said, as I went out the door. The taxi ride that night seemed very long. It was cold, still, and starry. The cab was a checker, and I felt somehow very small in it, like a child seeing the city for the first time. It was excitement I was feeling as the cab pulled up in front of the brown, I thought. A shudder worked up my spine, contemplating it or doing it. Then suddenly the door was open and Stevens was there. I felt an intense surge of relief. I am not an overly imaginative man, I think, at least not under ordinary circumstances, but this last thought had had all the eerie clarity of prophecy. I might have babbled aloud if I hadn't glanced at Stevens' eyes first. His eyes did not know me. His eyes did not know me at all. Then there was another instance of that eerie, prophetic clarity. I saw the rest of my evening, in perfect detail. 3 hours in a quiet bar, 3 scotches, perhaps 4, to dull the embarrassment of having been fool enough to go where I wasn't wanted. The humiliation my mother's advice had been intended to avoid, that which comes with knowing one has overstepped. I saw myself going home a little tipsy, but not in a good way. I saw myself merely sitting through the cab ride rather than experiencing it through that childlike lens of excitement and anticipation. I heard myself saying to Ellen, "It wears thin." After a while, Waterhouse told the same story about winning a consignment of T-bone steaks for the 3rd Battalion in a poker game. And they play hearts for $1 a point. Can you believe it? Go back? I suppose I might, but I doubt it. And that would be the end of it, except, I suppose, for my own humiliation. I saw all of this in the nothing of Stevens's eyes. Then the eyes warmed. He smiled slightly and said, "Mr. Adley, come in. I'll take your coat." I mounted the steps, and Stevens closed the door firmly behind me. How different a door can feel when you are on the warm side of it. He took my coat and was gone with it. I stood in the hall for a moment, looking at my own reflection in the pier glass, a man of 63 whose face was rapidly becoming too gaunt to look middle-aged, and yet the reflection pleased me. I slipped into the library. Johansson was there, reading his Wall Street Journal. In another island of light, Emlyn McCarran sat over a chessboard opposite Peter Andrews. McCarran was, and is, a cadaverous man, possessed of a narrow, blade-like nose. Andrews was huge, slope-shouldered, and choleric. I did not like the sound, not at all. "No," I said, in a voice that was not quite steady. "I think not." "Good night, then," Stephen said, and I crossed the threshold. I heard the heavy door close behind me. I heard the lock turn. And then I was walking toward the lights of 3rd Avenue, not looking back over my shoulder, somehow afraid to look back, as if I might see some frightful fiend matching me stride for stride, or glimpse some secret better kept than known. I reached the corner, saw an empty cab, and flagged it. "More war stories?" Ellen asked me that night. She was in bed with Philip Marlowe, the only lover she has ever taken. "There was a war story or two," I said, hanging up my overcoat. "Mostly I sat and read a book." "When you weren't oinking." "Yes, that's right, when I wasn't oinking. Listen to this. The first time I laid eyes on Terry Lennox, he was drunk in a Rolls-Royce silver Wraith outside the terrace of the Dancers," Ellen read. "He had a young-looking face, but his hair was bone-white. You could tell by his eyes that he was plastered to the hairline, but otherwise he looked like any other nice young guy in a dinner jacket who had been spending too much money in a joint that exists for that purpose and for no other. Nice, huh? It's the long goodbye, I said, taking off my shoes. You read me that same passage once every 3 years. It's part of your life cycle. She wrinkled her nose at me. Oink, oink. Thank you, I said. She went back to her book. I went out into the kitchen to get a bottle of Beck's. When I came back, she had laid the long goodbye open on the counterpane and was looking at me closely. David, are you going to join this club? I suppose I might. If I'm asked, I felt uncomfortable. I had perhaps told her another lie. If there was such a thing as membership at 249B East 35th, I already was a member.
End of Side 1.